Welcome back to the FDH Lounge. Rick Morris and Elaine Tanko, your FDH Lounge dignitaries and residents. Oh, but we got another one here on the phone lines, as it turns out, as well. Very happy to bring him in. He is, of course, the anchor of STN here in the daytimes, noon to 2 Eastern time, Monday through Friday. You can hear him on the network, and very proud to say that the first times that he was on the network here were on this show as an FDH Lounge dignitary. But much like what he had already been doing in New York at WVOX as a terrestrial radio host in the greatest market in the world, he has brought his skills here to STN as well, and very happy to have him on tonight. Very grateful he could be here with us, my good friend Steve Callis. Good to have you on tonight, Steve. Thank you so much for being here, my friend.
Great to be with you as always, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Well, I tell you what, I want to just underline it one more time here tonight that why you were invited to be here tonight. It is Bureau Night, the FDH New York Bureau, Steve Cervello. It's his birthday. He got he's generally got, you know, a lot of leeway when it comes to setting the agenda here. He's always got tremendous leeway, but complete leeway tonight. Steve, loaded up with your favorites. Well, you happen to be one of those here, Mr. Callis. You happen to be one of those, counselor. So that's why you are here tonight, and I agree with his judgment.
Well, I greatly appreciate that. I certainly wouldn't be anywhere without Steve. I wouldn't be on in the day. I wouldn't be on with you. So Steve does a great job, and I'm thankful he tracked me down.
Well, very kind of you. Good to have you on here, my friend. And again, I was able to catch a little bit of your show, particularly the replay in the 6 o'clock hour here, and get some notes on that. So I understand, and I was told by Paul Belfi separately that it was the subject of a little bit of mirth from the Barry Bonds trial. That you especially, I guess, got an email to that effect as far as the description of Barry Bonds' what would the technical term be, his nards, I guess, shrinking as a result of the testosterone, and what his former mistress said when she was on the stand there. So, you know, this is a whole thing. This case, as a legal deal here, I mean, the nuances of it, I guess, are interesting in the legal community. I think I can speak for the vast majority of flyover country. This whole thing basically is repetitive. Bonds, Clemens, you know, any of these guys in the news cycle. But anytime you get the sideshow aspects coming in, that's what makes it interesting and relevant. And that's what people are going to want to talk about.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because after I was on today, and that's, of course, as you know, 9 o'clock San Francisco time, there apparently was more activity relating, believe it or not, to the size of Barry Bonds' nards, as you call them. And here's what happened. Kimberly Bell, who was his mistress for 9 years, from 1994 to 2003, and probably had the most important testimony of the trial yesterday. We'll get to what happened today in a minute. But yesterday, she had testified, apparently, that his nards had shrunk significantly, and late in the day in California, which is 8 o'clock where I live, apparently she backed off that a little, and she said it wasn't significant, but it was some shrinkage, and I could certainly tell. And that led the lawyers going into court this morning asking the judge to give the jury an instruction to ignore everything she said about that subject. The judge refused to do that. Now, believe it or not, Rick, they're going to have a motion, if the defense wants to have a discussion with the judge to see whether they can convince the judge to change her mind and give the jury an instruction to ignore all testimony about whatever Kimberly Bell said about his testicle size, if you can believe that. So this isn't over, even though we thought it was, on that particular issue. But all jokes aside, that's kind of a serious issue, Rick, because you probably know earlier last week they had a medical expert come on purposely to set the groundwork for all of this testimony, not just Kimberly Bell, but Stan Conti, the former trainer of the Giants, not related to Victor Conti. But these people are coming in and giving eyesight testimony. Bonds' head got bigger. His testicles got smaller. He had acne on his back. Well, that's all set up by an expert, a drug expert, last week testifying that here's what happens when you take steroids. Here are the side effects when you take steroids. So obviously what the prosecution is trying to do correctly is lay out all of the side effects, and then bring in people who were there, like his mistress, like the Giants clubhouse trainer, to say, yeah, all this stuff happened to Barry Bonds.
Any truth to the rumor that Barry Bonds' lawyer first tried to go to the George Costanza shrinkage defense, and they said, no, sorry, wrong shrinkage?
You know, it's funny you say that, because they did not go to that defense, but they did come up with this defense. There's something called an orchidometer,
mm-hmm.
which, believe it or not, measures the size of one's testicles.
Okay.
And the judge and the defense tried to have any prosecution testimony from Kimberly Bell barred before she gave it, saying, of course, if you don't have the orchidometer to measure it, you can't measure it, so what's the proof? And, of course, the judge is allowing proof that, you know, I hate to be so graphic, but Kimberly Bell saw his testicles from 1994 to 2003, and her testimony is that they shrunk. So there is a lot going on. George Costanza would probably be some welcome relief in this trial. Maybe you could have him run in a Speedo or something during the trial. But it really has become, for lack of a better term, a big issue in the case.
Well, I remember that medical device, and unfortunately, the last time I was at the Cleveland Clinic, I broke that thing from sheer size. I sincerely apologize to them. That was
so clearly you're not taking steroids. Is
no,
that
no,
saying?
I am not. Nobody's ever mistaken me for a juice head in any realm here, Steve. But this whole thing, just you know, I was going to say inside and out, but maybe I should stay away from that. I don't even know what words to pick and choose here. But this entire case, again, it's taking the prurient stuff here to really even. It's an odd thing because I think that's the only thing that really makes it relevant to people, as sad as it is, because I've gone back and forth with the New York Bureau about this, you know, and he's always saying to me, you know, on topics like this or on the Clemens stuff, hey, let's get Steve Callis on to talk about this. And I always say to him, you know, unless there's carnival elements involved, there's got to be more interesting things we can talk to Steve about, because I think to whatever extent, you know, I'm sure the Bureau would say that I'm probably a captive of my mindset in the heartland, but frankly, I mean, I think a lot of times he's in that kind of East Coast media bubble here, and you know, maybe they're talking about it on ESPN or writing about it in the New York Post, but I got to tell you know, out here in between the coasts, you know, it ain't spilling a lot of beer down at the VFW hall, Steve. That's my perspective on it.
Well, I don't even think you're wrong to say, because I live in New York, as you know, it mm-hmm. hasn't been as big as one would think. Now, the Daily News, which has uncovered a lot of stuff over the years relating to steroids, not as much as the guys in San Francisco, but they follow it. They're live blogging. A New York Daily News guy is in the courtroom in San Francisco. The judge is allowing people to bring their laptops in, a bit unusual, so you can live blog. But I have to agree with you. It's something in New York, but it certainly is not as big as one would think. And here's the reason I think, aside from a general, I don't know, disgust or malaise about the whole thing. Keep in mind, this all happened 1999 through like 2002. His grand jury testimony was 2003. He was indicted in 2007, and he's going to trial last week in 2011. So there is that long time lag, if you will. But also, here's what I think doesn't really carry the day for a lot of people, and that is, this judge, Judge Ilston, Illston, in San Francisco, has already had a few of the Balco cases and has had some people get convicted for using the steroids and has not given them any jail time. So there really is that whole, why is the government spending all this money with all the things we have to deal with in America, with whatever they have to deal with in San Francisco, the U.S. Attorney's Office there? I think it's a real good question. If the end result is, and believe me, perjury is a very hard, you know, we can get into that a little bit. Perjury is a very hard thing to prove. You, the prosecutor and the jury, has to get inside Barry Bonds' head. The question isn't, did Barry Bonds take steroids or not? The question is, did Barry Bonds knowingly take steroids? And that's really the testimony that I would focus on, and I'll give you just a couple of things in a minute. But I have to agree with you. I'm sure it's bigger in New York than in the Midwest, but I don't think it's really that big. I've heard a number of commentary on sports talk in New York where it's just talked for a minute or two. You know, Clemens will be a bigger deal because, of course, Clemens was on the Yankees for a while, and Andy Pettit's going to be deeply involved. But I think at the end of the day, a lot of people are saying, we kind of know all you have to do is read Game of Shadows, one of the best research books you'll ever read. We kind of know he did it. Can he prove to a jury he didn't do it? If he gets acquitted, will he get into the Hall of Fame? I don't think so. So what is the end game here? And I'll say it again, perjury is a very hard thing to prove.
Oh, it is. There's no question about that, Steve. And I think that's the main thing that we start hearing. Speaking of sideshows and everything, that the defense is playing into that. I mean, now having said that, that's not to say that the kitchen sink they throw may not be made out of 24 karat solid gold from their perspective, because it may be. But the notion of, oh, he didn't know what was in the clear and the cream that he was applying to himself, because I'm already hearing a little bit about that as far as trial balloons and stuff. When you use the word knowingly on this, and that knowingly is the key word here in the whole perjury deal, that's clearly what they're going for. Oh, he may have roided it up because, oh, maybe Gary Sheffield poisoned him or whoever else he was working out with. And you know, as ludicrous as it may seem, all you got to do is plant the seed of doubt in the jury's heads and off you skip.
No, that's 100% correct. And let me give you exactly what happened today with Jason Giambi, who testified. Now, the theory is, and you probably know the background, I assume most of your audience does as well, Greg Anderson, who is Barry Bonds' lifelong friend and personal trainer and allegedly the guy who gave him the steroids, who injected him with steroids, he has refused to testify. He's in jail for the duration of the trial. He was in jail for over a year during the Balco grand jury. He refused to testify. So they don't have the best witness, or I should say the best potential witness against Bonds. So what they're doing is they're bringing in today Jason Giambi and his brother Jeremy Giambi, and they both testified that they met Greg Anderson, that Greg Anderson gave them steroids. He sent them the cream. He sent them the clear. He sent them the schedule. You know, they found the schedule of Barry Bonds, or a schedule with BB on it and what he was supposed to take every day. You might have seen them in the Marion Jones case when she finally came clean. They produced the schedules that she had, and they were just like the one would BB on them for Barry Bonds. But that evidence is not in because Greg Anderson is not testifying. They can't get them in. So what they're doing is they're bringing in other guys who dealt with Anderson, and they're going through the same thing. Anderson sent us the cream. Anderson sent us the clear. Anderson sent us a schedule, and we followed the schedule. Now, look how smart Jason Giambi and all these other guys appear to be compared to Barry Bonds, because they all admitted what they did. They kept their $60, $70, $80 million that they made while they hit home runs illegally, and they're now coming in testifying, and nothing can happen to them. But here are two guys, two Hall of Famers before they ever took a steroid, in my opinion, Bonds and Clemens, who have decided to, you know, go the deny, deny, deny to the bitter end route. And they both might get convicted. But again, perjury is a tough thing to prove. But I wanted to show you one thing that the defense did today that I thought was fantastic. And all I focus on as an attorney is, what is it that they have that's going to prove that Bonds knew that these were steroids? That's the question. And here's what happened today. When Jason Giambi testified, he said, Anderson gave me this stuff, he sent me this stuff, I paid him for it, I followed the schedule, I did all of this stuff. But then on cross-examination, and that's really the interesting stuff to always look at in a trial, one of Bond's attorneys read Jason Giambi's 2003 grand jury testimony when he testified that Anderson had told him, quote, the clear and the cream had steroid-like effects without being a steroid, close quote. Giambi agreed with that testimony. Now, to me, Rick, that might be the most important thing that happened today. Why? Because it fits right in with what Barry Bonds' defense lawyers are going to argue. He didn't know it was steroid-like. It wasn't a steroid. And if the jury believes that, then that's a key piece of evidence today that's going to help Barry Bonds get acquitted.
Well, again, you know, all he's got to do is prey on the stupidity of enough people on that jury and be able to stir the doubts here. But again, it's the whole spectacle, and I'm not surprised that even in New York, and I would guess even in San Francisco, it's probably diminishing returns is how much people are paying attention to. In San Francisco in particular, with the Giants just having won the World Series last year,
right?
I think the burdens of the Barry Bonds era have probably been put to rest. There, they've got more important things to think about as far as the start of the season goes. I want to get to some baseball with you in a second here, but before we put any of this legal mumbo-jumbo to bed completely, similar to Barry Bonds, it's only really worth talking about LT for the punchline value of this. We've talked about it before, and, you know, he now has had to go through the sentencing. Dude's got to register as a sex offender for being a kid toucher. But that line about when he was asked about his prostitutes and patronizing an underage one, hey, I don't card him. I mean, that's some pretty funny stuff right there. The guy's a train wreck. The guy has lived a pathetic existence for the last close to two decades or however long it's been, but damn it, I'll give credit where credit's due. That's a funny line.
Well, again, one of the greatest football players of all time, no doubt about it, but he is a train wreck. His not going to jail post, not going to jail comments are like, again, it could be a 30-minute comedy show. You know, the oldest business in the world, and what you said, I don't card them. You know, I was away for 10 or 11 days and I needed something. I mean, if you heard or saw the interview with him after he got no jail time, you almost shake your head. It's like the guy doesn't get it, or he's one of the funniest guys on earth. But I will say this, it was surprising to me, generally speaking, in New York, and this is 30 miles north of New York City, so it's not the liberal den of iniquity New York City's painted to be. I could say that. I grew up in New York City, Rick. But, and you go 30 miles north of New York City, it's a different country. It's New York, but it's a different world up there. And I think the reason he got off, and it was not discussed at all during his sentencing, but it was discussed at the time he took his plea, he has agreed, Lawrence Taylor has agreed to cooperate, not just in this particular case with this particular pimp, but according to prosecutors, in multiple cases in multiple jurisdictions. To me, that means state and federal, or maybe other states. I don't know exactly. But the news in New York when that happened was, believe it or not, Lawrence Taylor had become a federal snitch. And that's unusual, or at least it's unusual enough to get him out of going to jail. When you sleep with an underage girl outside New York City, I don't know what would happen in the city necessarily, but outside of New York City, you generally go to jail. And Arthur Idala, his lawyer, did a good job getting him no jail time, but that's because he agreed to cooperate on multiple cases. Now, I don't know who he's cooperating against, but you got to think that the guys who are in this business, Rick, aren't the nicest guys in the world. And I don't know if Lawrence Taylor is looking over his shoulder now whenever he goes out in public. I just don't know. But to have an understanding that he avoided jail time, got 6 years probation, and there's a hearing on April 12th as to what level sex offender he'll be. There are three levels in New York, and depending on how serious it's viewed to be, he might have to do more things, but he's not going to jail. I'd still be a little concerned if I were him, if he's testifying against multiple bad guys in multiple jurisdictions who are, for lack of a better term, pimps in the sex trade in the New York metropolitan area. That strikes me as potentially a different kind of problem for Lawrence Taylor.
Well, and that's, I mean, toward the end there, you might have preemptively answered the question I was going to ask you, because something doesn't ring true about this. I mean, if we think back to the status that he once had, legendary edge pass rusher, maybe the greatest of all time in that regard. Oh, okay, at one point in time, we could view him as a VIP. To look at him now, I think junkie, John, convicted kid toucher, who could he possibly roll over on? Is he important enough in 2011 to have knowledge that the feds would be like, oh, that's some good stuff there. We're going to go get some big fish convicted. I mean, maybe if he's dealt with some pimps, and you alluded to that towards the end, so maybe you started to preemptively answer this question. I don't know. But my first thought is, who the hell does Lawrence Taylor know right now that's important enough for the feds to risk giving him what looks like a slap on the wrist?
Well, I don't know if he's going to give them these lower level or even mid level guys, but clearly it was more than this guy. This one guy was a pimp in the Bronx who brought this Spanish girl up, and another thing that you'll probably be hearing about, you know, Gloria Allred, the famed California women's rights lawyer, flew in to be at the sentencing with the victim. The victim actually spoke on camera afterwards. She wanted to make a victim impact statement before Taylor got sentenced because she and her lawyer both thought Taylor should do time, and I'll say it again. He should have done time. Normally he would have done time, but cooperated, I'm guessing, against two or three or four lower to mid-level guys, and maybe what they're trying to do, Rick, is get to the lower to mid-level guys and get them to roll over the big guys. I don't know. They were very vague about exactly what he had done, except that he had given a lot of cooperation. But the judge would not let the victim, who was on camera all over the country, you could have seen her that day, she made a statement and wanted to make a statement. And she's now 17. She was 16 at the time. But the judge would not let her make the victim impact statement in court because under New York law, since Lawrence Taylor pled to two misdemeanors, not any felonies, a victim impact statement is only allowed during felonies. So she was barred from making her statement in court. She did come outside with Gloria Allred and make a statement outside of court. You know, he should have gone to jail. What he did to me was wrong. I was a young kid. I didn't lie to him, blah, blah, blah. But the real question, of course, is if you're bringing Gloria Allred in from California, and this kid isn't paying for her to come across country, you can bet on that, there's going to be a civil lawsuit coming because the guy did plead to two misdemeanors, which is going to give Gloria Allred and whoever she hires to try the case in New York. And I'm getting ahead of myself, but I'm 98% sure there's going to be a lawsuit, the victim v. Lawrence Taylor, in New York somewhere, probably up there in New City. And Gloria Allred will hire a big-time attorney, and Taylor will try and settle it out of court. And then, as always, it'll be all about the money, and it'll be settled with no admission of guilt, blah, blah, blah. But there's still a lot going on. I think you're right. I don't think he can get to the top guys, but I'll say it again. He must have given them something more than one pimp in the Bronx for them to let him get off with no jail time. That's an unusual result when you sleep with an underage girl. If she had been of age, it wouldn't have mattered. It's Lawrence Taylor who's like 10,000 other Johns, but it becomes a different animal when it's an underage girl. And again, to me, still a surprising result.
Sucks to be LT if Gloria Allred's involved. You know, I was talking about that a minute ago, him being maybe the greatest edge pass rusher of all time. I'll tell you what, I'd put her 40-time Gloria Allred up against his in heels if there's a TV camera present. You know, she could run down anybody to get in front of a TV camera, but that's very dangerous. And, of course, he's such a pompous moron that all it would take is Gloria Allred saying, the condom we recovered is that of a – it's a Magnum condom. Oh, he'll cop to whatever you want if she says that. He is such an idiot. He is so – he has so little – judgment on what to say at all times. I mean, and the funny thing is, I talked about it earlier in the show, it's WrestleMania week, so I've seen some retrospectives in recent years here, and going back to 95, I mean, as recently as 95, he was there, he was in decent enough shape. I'm not going to say it was the greatest match ever, but he was competent to at least do that, but clearly the slide has just kept on going in the years that follow here. Gloria Allred, that is just going to be the biggest media circus imaginable. I had not heard that until you mentioned it.
Oh, yeah, and that's what happened, and she was front and center hugging the victim, and, you know, the victim was half crying. And look, I'm not diminishing what happened to the victim, but this becomes what you just said. It becomes a media circus. Someone did ask her point blank whether there'd be a lawsuit, and she gave the old, you know, we're weighing our options. But again, I don't know who paid her way across country. She might have herself, Gloria Allred, but I don't think a 17-year-old from the Bronx who's going up to get $300 from LT, who probably only kept, you know, 50 or 100 of it because she's got a pimp. Frankly, I don't think she's coming across to just sit and stand in front of the camera with the victim. I think there's a lawsuit coming down the pike. I just don't know when it is.
Yeah, well, yeah, all I can say to LT is ask Tiger Woods how that ends up going. So that is not going to be very pleasant for him by the time that moves on here. Some other things I wanted to get to here tonight with you. Definitely want to talk some NFL lockout because I know you've covered it on your show substantively here, as you do everything, I should say. And you've also written about it at stevecallis.com. Before we get to that, we were talking about bonds before and baseball, and I said there was something I wanted to ask you about this. I got to tell you, in talking to another one of our dignitaries for the FDH Lounge, Nate Noy, he's coming on a little later tonight to talk some college hoops. He's really been on top of that and been covering it for us strong this winter. And we were talking about the Final Four this weekend, and he said, I got to tell you, I'm actually more geeked for Saturday than I am for Thursday. And I said, Thursday? What the hell's Thursday? Oh, it's opening day. I said, that's right. It is. What I got, I don't know what your sense of it is, Steve. From where I'm sitting, what a fiasco. I do not see the awareness of this that you would think. I do not see, I mean, ESPN's running their commercials. We're going to have these games on Thursday and on Friday. But, I mean, outside of that, if you just want to talk, and you're in a pretty baseball-crazed market in New York, so maybe you're seeing something different from me. But across this country, the fact that it's Thursday instead of Monday this year, I think it's really sneaking up on people. And I'm not going to say that attendance is going to be down because everybody will pick up their newspapers opening day. Oh, it's opening day. But there's something wrong if people are just waking up to the fact it's opening day when it's opening day.
Well, I think for New York anyway, especially for Met fans, you know, they can't wait for it to start because the Met-Madoff fiasco has been going on now, as you know, since early December. And so you've had December, January, February, March all screw up ownership. What did they do? Or at least according to a bankruptcy trustee. So I think people are anxious. The problem for the Mets, of course, already, and there is, I don't want to say it's excitement about the Mets. It's, are we going to be able to compete? And now, I don't know if you heard, but Jason Bay went on the disabled list today. Mm-hmm. Nothing to do with a concussion, some kind of rib cage thing. Carlos Beltran apparently played today, and you're going to have to see if he can walk tomorrow, frankly, because the last time he played on March 8th, he didn't play again until today. So the Mets have a lot of problems. Their pitching is down. They did get rid of Oli Perez and Luis Castillo. But from a Met perspective, I think it's almost a sigh of relief. Frankly, oh man, here comes Thursday. Hurry up, we need to play. The Yankees are the Yankees are the Yankees. I think you're right. I think it's a little different vibe with a Thursday start rather than a Monday or a Tuesday in Cincinnati. It always started when certainly when we were kids. But I think the theory is, well, I think there are two theories. A, they're starting in March, which always struck me as absurd. And by the way, it might snow Thursday evening in New York, and the Yankees are supposed to play at 1 o'clock, so you got to hope they get that game in quickly before it starts snowing. I mean, just absurd. But that's what the schedule makes does to you nowadays. I've always said the first 2 weeks of the season should be played in every southern town there is. If you could play every game in Texas or Florida or Atlanta or somewhere south, they should have every game unless you've got a dome. And you know what happened in Minnesota now? They don't even have a dome in Minnesota, which, you know, makes my head explode, but whatever. But I think, generally speaking, I think what baseball is looking for now is a boom right into the weekend. So rather than have games Monday or Tuesday, and then you have Wednesday, Thursday before you get into the weekend, and maybe nobody can get to the ballpark till Friday night, Saturday, Sunday, I think what they want to do now is one day opening day, that's always a big day, and then they're looking to have big days Friday, Saturday, Sunday right away. I think it's attendance-related and also, of course, timing-related. To me, to start a season in March, again, just strikes me as lunacy, but as you know, that's the way it's been the last few years, and that's the way it's going to be.
Not only that, Steve, I mean, I've looked at it before. I agree with you on that, and I think for a couple of years they did try to do that, all southern markets and domes to start the season. Evidently, that went out the window. But here's the thing. You've got to include domes, and you've got to include a handful of instances that are not going to be great, because when we say south, again, there's not enough pure south ones to where you can avoid a mid-Atlantic thing like Baltimore. You throw in Baltimore,
right.
That may not be so great. And even a dome? How about Seattle? Which, by the way, is not a fully enclosed dome. It is not heated. Nothing like sitting there in your snowmobile suit watching opening day, Steve.
No, you're right.
So, but that would have to be an area they would use if they did it that way, because at least you're not going to get a rain out or anything like that. It does enclose the field sufficiently in that way. Yeah, this whole thing of going to Thursday just strikes me as being a fiasco, because I can only speak for myself and my friends that I've talked to, but there does not seem to be the general sense of anticipation. You kind of build to the next Monday. Yeah, Thursday's going to be here. I don't know. To me, I think it's going to feel very anticlimactic. To me, this is up there with the opening series fiascos in Japan that MLB's tried to do
please.
In the past. Now, I don't think anything good can come of this.
Yeah, well, again, I can tell you in New York for Met fans, I'm not a Met fan, but for Met fans, they can't wait for it to start. It could have started, you know, Monday or last week for them. They would have been happy to play in the snow, because the off-the-field stuff is still surrounding the Mets and is going to be a big story for the next few months. And again, as for the Yankees coming up with huge pitching problems, you know, Is A.J. Burnett really going to turn it around? He's like 34 years old. Well, he was terrible last year. He's going to be great this year. We'll have to see. They have a new pitching coach, Larry Rothschild. But certainly the Yankees have a lot of problems, but they can have a lot of problems and win the wild card because, as you know, in their 1-8 lineup, they're stacked. I mean, they're stacked on the field, virtually an all-star just about every position. So we'll see what happens. I'm kind of looking forward to it. I love baseball. To me, it really didn't matter if you did it on a Monday or a Thursday. I'd rather, and I know I'm dreaming, but I'd rather they have, like when we were kids, Rick, I'd rather they have 10 doubleheaders a year and they could move the season 5 or 6 days in from the front end and 4 or 5 days in from the back end, and then we wouldn't be playing baseball in March and we wouldn't be playing baseball in November. But that's just me. Obviously, the owners will never. You know, it's funny when you think about the good old days where the owners would give up 10 or 12 days a year where they would give you 2 games for the price of one. That was fantastic stuff when I was a kid. We went to every doubleheader for exactly that reason. And then, of course, somebody woke up in the, I don't know, I think it started really the early 90s and said, we're not giving up one date anymore. We're having 81 dates in our building. And you can understand that from a business perspective. But personally, I think what the doubleheaders did is it gave the players a few more off days during the year, but it also made you not start as early and not finish as late during the season.
Yeah, and that was how, even with a 154-game schedule, slightly condensed from what it is now, how they could do it in significantly less time than the modern schedule takes. So that's a very good point as well. By the way, the whole thing about Carlos Beltran and a bad contract for a team, I wouldn't know anything about anything like that. Travis Hafner. So, you know, it's not like everybody's best team or everybody's favorite team doesn't have something like that. But, yeah, the Beltran thing, that could definitely hurt the Mets as well in the National League East here. And, again, I think the periphery of wild card contention, even something like that, is probably asking too much. But the least you can hope, I guess, is that 2011 ends up being a year for Sandy Alderson et al. To be able to clear the decks for future seasons here. As I indicated, at stevecallis.com, of course, you've written on the NFL lockout. You've spoken about it on your program, I believe also on your terrestrial show on WVOX in New York. And I understand here that you had spoken about it as well on WFAN in New York with Evan Roberts and Sid Rosenberg. So you clearly are looking at this from all aspects of what's happening. A lot of things, I think, are really kind of opaque to the rest of us. So we can look at the precedents, I suppose, of things that have happened previously. Decertification, we've been here before. The Players Association was able to do it previously. There's some talk as to whether or not it's going to fly for this time. The union did back off wisely on holding their Alterna draft event the weekend of the NFL draft, but there's some talk now potentially that that same judge who ruled that the owners couldn't sit on all that free TV money like that, like they were trying to do, may also put an end to the lockout before the draft rolls around. So what are some of the big picture things that are happening right now and will be over the next 30 days, Steve?
Well, actually, what's happened is it's kind of interesting. Everyone assumed, including me, that David Doty, who did write the opinion on the $4 billion TV money not going to the owners, and who has made every decision and taken every case since the late 1980s in Minnesota with the Players Association, he's not going to be the judge. As of right now, they have a different judge. Now, that could change before April 6th, which is the date of the hearing for the injunction the players are asking for. But as of right now, it's going to be a different Judge Nelson, but I did a little research on her, and she's a rookie judge. She has been in the Minnesota area for 20 years. She was a magistrate, which you probably know is a level below an actual federal judge, so she's been in that courthouse for 10 years. I think she kind of knows, like, what's going on, and she's certainly going to know that back in 89 through 93, Judge Doty held it was perfectly legal for the players' union to decertify for the specific purpose of going to court. So I personally don't see how that's going to be overturned, although the NFL has gone to the National Labor Relations Board to try and get it overturned there. Again, I don't see how the NLRB is going to go against a federal judge's holding with these same parties, by the way. And you may know that in the settlement agreement in the Reggie White case from 1993, which started free agency in the NFL, the owners in the NFL agreed that they would not if the union decertified, they would not fight that in court. But now the owners have come up with some language. Apparently they agreed not to fight it in court after they decertified. So what the owners did, you talk about, I don't want to say slimy, but certainly away from what you would expect the agreement to be, Rick, what the owners did was they filed with the NLRB before they decertified. Now they're saying, yeah, well, we agreed we wouldn't fight it after, but we didn't file the complaint after we filed the complaint before. That strikes me as something that's not going to fly with the NLRB or with the federal judge. So I think it's going to be allowed to go forward, and certainly Judge Doty, in his $4 billion TV money opinion, pretty much intimated that if it was up to him, he would grant the injunction. And I'll say it again, a rookie judge in the same courthouse with a guy who's been writing NFL decisions for over 20 years, I kind of doubt that she's going to buck that system. And there's still also a chance that that case will be transferred to Judge Doty. I'm personally surprised it hasn't been. But this is all a prelude to the April 6th hearing on the injunction. And I thought there'd be negotiations between now and then, but apparently there haven't been any negotiations at all, Rick.
Let me drill it down. Two pretty basic questions that I think probably are too intricate for not just myself, but probably a majority of the viewers out there to grasp. The first one would be, and we've talked about this on the show previously, how are we even having an NFL draft with a lockout going on here? Had it been stipulated in the previous CBA that everything grinds to a halt except for the draft? What's the process by which this is still happening? If this is Mad Max Thunderdome here, there are no rules, blah, 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 then how do we even have the mechanism in place for a draft?
No, my understanding is exactly what you said, that it was in the collective bargaining agreement that the 2011 draft would take place even if there was not a union per se. Apparently, there were always thoughts that this kind of thing was going to happen. You know, first the players had the right to opt out and didn't. Then the owners had the right to opt out and did. So, yes, that's kind of in the agreement. I think personally, Rick, the rookies are in a very tough spot because, to me, the NFL Players Association is going to sell the rookies down the river here. They're no longer getting Sam Bradford money. That's not happening. So if I'm a rookie who's going to be drafted, I don't know, 1 through 10 in the NFL draft, I'm not so sure. Now, they got a rookie to be a plaintiff. I forget the guy's name, the kid who won the Butkus Award this year. They got a rookie to be a plaintiff in the lawsuit, but the rookies, by definition, no matter what happens here, they're not going to get the big money that Sam Bradford got last year. So if I'm a rookie, I'm not even sure who to listen to, because the players, and of course you want to be in the Players Association and you want to be in with those players, but they're going to give up my rookie pay scale that's been in effect, where all these guys are making 20, 30 million, 40 million guaranteed, you know, Stafford and Bradford and all these guys the last few years. These new rookies aren't making that. So I don't think there's anyone really sticking up for their best interests. And the agents in those situations are in an interesting position, because invariably if they have one of the top 10 guys this year, they've had a ton of guys the last few years, and they've already got those guys their money, but they're not going to be able to get the rookies their money. But you're right, it was in the CBA that there would be a draft. And I think those rookies should be allowed to go to that draft, because it is a once-in-a-lifetime. I don't think the Players Association should try and keep them out. It is a once-in-a-lifetime thing to walk up on that stage. It's something you'll never forget, whether you become a Hall of Famer or a bust. That's one day you'll never forget.
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's it was a bad move by the Players Association to try to have that alternative event in place in the first place here. I was, again, the part of me that's rooting for a train wreck wanted to see it, but they're not going to do that. But I guess, by the way, speaking of which, it's no longer the Players Association. Again, for those of us out there that just don't get this, this whole thing about that theoretically a deal could still be done, what am I missing here? If it's just a trade association for the players now at this point, let's say DeMaurice Smith and Roger Goodell hashed out everything on a cocktail napkin tomorrow.
Yep.
How can a deal be made without an actual players union in existence?
Because they still are an association. It's two different things, union and association. The association, because all the players want to eventually come back to a union. And understand, back in 83, when 90, when they had the White decision, White against the NFL, there was not a union for another year. So they went as a Players Association for a full season and then became a union again a year later. So I think the same kind of thing can happen. They can certainly represent individual players as an association, not as a union. And frankly, it's almost a legal fiction, but it's a legal fiction. We decertify the union specifically because under the collective bargaining agreement, if there is a union, the union has to collectively bargain with the owners. If there is no union, individual players, and you know the plaintiffs, Brady and Manning and Breeze, individual plaintiffs can go into court and sue the NFL for an antitrust violation because there is no longer a collectively bargain for agreement that can, in essence, give them an antitrust exemption. So you're right, it's a good point, but the reality is they're just trying to work a deal. And I'll tell you what, when they do settle this thing, and I still think it'll be settled, it would be beyond stupid if they couldn't carve up $9 billion by September when the games start. But when that happens, there won't be a union in the 2011 season. I don't think there'll be a union till 2012, just like back in 93.
Interesting. Well, give us your best bottom line prediction on this. I've been saying for a while now, I think this stretches into the season. I think it's going to be until the players start missing the game checks. I understand that some of them make some money in the off season due to bonuses and whatnot, but for the vast majority of them make the vast majority of their money off of game checks here, and I don't see anything changing until they start to miss this. I'm going out on the limb saying this thing gets settled probably late September, early October, couple weeks of truncated training camp. We start a half season in November. That's my guess. What do you say?
Well, I can tell you this, and maybe you know this. The NFL owners already have a plan for an eight-game season.
So, do they?
Yes. That's clearly a message to the players that we're willing to go into the season. Maybe I'm an optimist, but I cannot believe, because I don't think they're getting this TV money. You know, the whole thing, we're getting the TV money, but the back end of the TV money was, if we lose games, we're giving some of that TV money back. So I think it's going to cut both ways come July into August, and I am hopeful, and I think, again, how stupid would it be, Rick, for people to miss half a season trying to split up $9 billion. I mean, it's almost too funny to say that the multimillionaires and the billionaires can't split $9 billion. So I prefer to say that there will be so much pressure put on the owners and the players, not in March, April, May, but come June, July, as we get to training camp. So I'm going to say they're not going to miss a game, but there'll be a shorter training camp, and they're going to start on time. But I don't, you know, it's certainly not out of the realm of possibility. You're going out on a limb, but it happened in 1987. And if you were around back then, as I was, what a disaster that was with the replacement players. That was just beyond pathetic. I mean, I think it solidified the NFL as a great league with its great players, because when people saw what the replacement players are, nobody would go to the games, nobody would watch on TV. It was a disaster. And I'm a Giant fan, and the Giants just never thought it was going to happen. So they didn't even bother to go out and get any good replacement players, and they got hammered early on. So by the time when they came back, again, this is between their two Super Bowls now, you'd think they'd have a great team. By the time they came back, they were done for the season already. They're one of those teams, you know, that just didn't prepare well. So, yeah, I've read a couple of reports, I'll say a few weeks ago, where there was at those NFL owners' meetings in New Orleans, there was some kind of plan, if necessary, to run an eight-game season. Now, that might just be throwing it out there so to let the players know, yeah, you making $16 million this year? Well, guess what? You're going to make $8 million this year, and that'll make some of the bigger guys as well get a little nervous. So I think there's going to be pressure by the judge on April 12th. And again, I was sure if Doty was the judge, he was going to grant the injunction. I still think this Judge Nelson will as well. But because there's nothing happening, Rick, as you know, April, May, I mean, you know, there's not really a whole lot going on until summertime. I think push is going to come to shove in July and August, and I think they'll get into camp, maybe a shortened camp, and they'll start on time. But I don't think what you suggest is out of the realm of possibility either.
Well, they'd be idiots not to have the eight-game schedule because, as I say, I think they're going to need it, but we'll see how that goes. Of course, everybody can always follow what you're doing at stevekallas.com, K-A-L-L-A-S. So that your writings, of course, can be found there, as well as the blog at WFAN.com, the terrestrial show, WVOX in New York, Thursday nights, 6 to 7 Eastern time, and of course, weekdays here, noon Eastern time on the Sports Talk Network. The Steve Kallas Media Empire continuing to expand its tentacles by the day here, and we are proud to have you as an FDH Lounge dignitary, my man. Thank you so much for coming on Bureau Night.
Thanks very much for having me, Rick. I just want to say one more thing. I think they put up at sportstalknetwork.com a number of these columns we've spoken about, like the Barry Bonds trial week one recap, like the NFL lockout. I think you can find it right there as well. But, yeah, it's kind of all over the place. I appreciate your kind words.
No problem, buddy. Good to have you on. Look forward to doing it again here sometime soon. It's been great to have you as one of our dignitaries for some time now. Thank you so much.
Same here. Have a good one.
All right. Thanks, pal. Steve Callis, everybody. He is a New York sports lawyer and sports talk show personality slash blogger. Steve is the go-to guy at the nexus of sports, ethics, and the law. He handles all of these things flawlessly, as you just heard. It was our pleasure to have him for Bureau Night.